This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Nikia Hargrove, who's the author of an incredibly interesting book called Mama, A Queer Black Woman's Story of a Family Lost and Found. And I do want to say that Nikia is also a novice or new bookseller with a bookstore in Stratford, Connecticut, the town that I live in, called Obodo Serendipity Books. So it's really a pleasure to have you here, Nikia.
Thank you. I am so excited to have this conversation with you, David. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, I'm happy to do this. I don't usually get to talk to people who are local and that I know in some personal way. So I've read the book and, you know, it can't help but say that whenever someone writes a personal memoir that is so personal and immediate, you have to wonder, and I have to ask, like, what gives you the courage to expose yourself so personally and fully in public? You know, I just think it is a really hard thing to do. I cannot imagine it for myself. So I have to ask you, how does that work?
Well, it didn't happen overnight. So there is that. You know, when I was, the book is you know, heavily about my relationship with my mother, who was incarcerated for a good portion of my life. And during that time, I would go and visit her, and I felt very lonely. I felt like I was the only, even though I was sitting in a waiting room with other kids, I felt like I was the only one in my school going through that. And I was definitely the only one in my family going through that, having to go visit my mom in a jail, in a prison. And as I grew into an adult and wrote more, I realized that, you know, I wasn't the only one going through it when I was going through it, because there are over a million kids who are impacted by the prison system. And I wanted this book to speak to them as well, to let them know that they are not alone, even though it feels lonely when you're in it. And there is a kind of shame that you carry, even as an adult. I will say I carried shame even as an adult, knowing that when I spoke of my mother, I couldn't leave out prison or I couldn't leave out jail, because there were so many years of there being a gap in our relationship because she was physically not there. And so when I found the courage to share my story, it came by way of writing essays for different publications. And I realized in the writing that I was also releasing the shame that I held on to for so long. And it felt good. So there was definitely a freedom in that.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting because we, you know, when we think about writing, particularly, I mean, most people, you know, you think about it in the context of fiction. Fiction is made up, we think. And there's a, you know, always a tendency to be reductive with fiction, to read the book and then try to figure out how does that relate to the person who wrote it, you know, in their real life, which I think is a mistake. Mm-hmm. But in a memoir, obviously, you don't have to feel that tension. But as you are telling your truth, the psychological value is, I mean, is that, I guess I'm sort of circling around saying that I think that when fiction writers write, there's a certain element of psychological exploration and self exploration that's going on that doesn't necessarily have to be read literally. But with memoir, it is literal.
Right.
I mean, did you feel, and you just mentioned that you felt releasing the shame, mm-hmm. I assume other, it mm-hmm. also helps you forgive your mother for being who she was and for leaving you, essentially abandoning you for so much of your life. But did you feel like that was the purpose, the primary purpose, or is it more that this is a way for you to to learn yourself.
The primary purpose being to forgive?
Well, the primary purpose being to, or to release, you know, in other words, to let go of feelings. Okay. Or was it more to be transformative so that it helped you become yourself?
Ironically, I will say neither of those. The reason that the book came to life was solely because of other people. I did not want to leave this earth without having, one, been honest about what happened to me growing up, because I think there's such a, and it's cultural in many ways in Black and African American households to keep whatever happens behind your closed door there. And, you know, I didn't want to do that. And that is not the life that I live today of keeping everything hidden. And so the purpose of this book is to be out in the world as honest and transparent as I am in it, as a Black person living in this world, as a queer person living in this world, as a mom, and as a woman. But I really wanted the book to represent truth-telling, and in that, the story of my life. So the purpose for me is just to provide, and I don't want to say just because I feel like it's very important, but to be hope for someone, you know, to recognize that we are a community of people. And as much as I like to do things on my own, the lesson of realizing I needed help came when Jonathan came into the world, because I wasn't able to do it alone.
So we should talk about that, because that's a really the central, the initial central story of the book revolves around your brother being born by your mother later in her life.
Right.
And you were by then a teenager.
I was an adult by the time he was born. I was her first child. She had me when she was 18.
Right. So you were just out of college.
I was just out of college, 1 year out of college, undergrad. Mm-hmm.
So, and then you make this momentous decision.
So at 24, I was leaving college, and around the same time, my mother shared with me that she was pregnant with this baby, and she wanted to keep him. And she did. She gave birth to him when she was 41, and he was born a month early because she had relapsed. She used crack cocaine for as long as I can remember, but definitely since she was in her early 20s. And so she relapsed. And that meant that she had an early birth. And Jonathan was born and then immediately taken away. Custody was taken away from my mother and put into Child Protective Services the moment he was born because of his toxicology level. And so that moment, my life changed, because I knew that my mother could not mother him alone, even if she were to get custody of him back. And so I put my life on hold. I was going into a pre-med program in hopes of being an obstetrician. And I paused that and drove from my little apartment and made my way to Long Island, where I never left, because Jonathan was born on Long Island. And I was the person who took him from the hospital, and we have been together ever since.
And it was a pretty big undertaking. I mean, not just for you it's not unusual for people to have babies when they're 23, 24. This happens every day, but, you had to make a decision, you know, in a kind of under pressured circumstances.
Right. I mean, yes. But also, David, you know, there's no other way to explain it. And I don't want to get too woo-woo here, but it was definitely something bigger than me that made me stay on Long Island and say yes to this. And it was God. I mean, there is no other way around it, because I was able to live with my aunt. I had to quit my job. I had no way of paying my bills, and I had to rely on family members to do that, because I was there for Jonathan every single moment. From the moment we left the hospital, and now, spoiler, he is off in college, and I received a text message from him this morning at 7 a.m. So, you know, we are stronger today because of what we went through collectively. And Jonathan went through traumas. And so I took him from the hospital, and then I went through many, many years of custody battles, supervised visits with his biological father. And so we've had quite our journey over the last 18 years.
Yeah, and you've engaged, I mean, your larger family has been a big part. I mean, first of all, they helped raise you when you were young, and right. then they stepped up and helped you raise Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, my grandparents raised me. So my mother's parents raised me. And when Jonathan came along, they were like, we can't take any more kids. We are getting old, and we cannot raise any more of her children. And my grandmother took it upon herself to be the one to try to find Jonathan a home, because if he did not find a home within our family, so a kinship placement, he would go to foster care. And that was his only option. And the clock was ticking, because he was born on November 28th. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, he was a healthy baby. Like, there was no reason to keep him in the hospital. And so so the clock was ticking, and my grandmother called across the United States to all family members she could think of, and she kept hitting a wall. No one wanted this baby. And I kind of held close to my chest the fact that I wanted him, and that I was of age to make that decision. And so me expressing that to my family came with pushback, for sure, and anger towards my mom. You know, why does Nikki have to put her life on hold to deal with this baby? But David, I couldn't go on as a 24, 25 year old knowing that my half brother was in foster care, and I was a capable being at the time. Still am, but you know, I could take him. And so my family came around after some time in that they accepted my decision, because I wasn't returning him anywhere. And so my biological family, they helped me pay my cell phone bill and my car payment, and provided me a place to live and space for Jonathan and I to be together. And so they all came together in ways that are natural in terms of Black families piecing together a home for a child. And so I'm very grateful for them coming to sort of rescue us both. And there is a scene in the book where I talk about the women in my family who were standing side by side with me when I was in family court fighting for Jonathan. And you know, I think back to them because their voices were so needed and loud during a time when I needed it the most. And I look up to them in so many ways because of them.
Right. Maybe in so many ways you've become them.
In some ways, I'm very quiet, though, David. Like, I'm that stereotypical writer, that introvert who likes her alone time and likes to be one with my laptop. But I'm learning how to be more assertive in expressing myself publicly.
Well, but also not just publicly, but in the in this sort of in your life, you have taken, you know, you've taken your life and made it your own. And that's another part of the story in this book, which is you coming out as a gay woman in a family that maybe was not prepared for that.
No, they weren't, David. They were not prepared. But now as a mother, I ask myself, like, can you ever be prepared for things that your kids will tell you? You know, you just sort of go with it and try to learn, you know, and be accepting. And so in time, that was what happened in my family. You know, it was a shock to my grandmother. It was a shock to my aunt, my mom's sister. But it wasn't a shock to my cousin, Natasha. It was sort of a shock, but not really. And Natasha and I we have a very funny story. I was early. I was born early. I was born 3 months early. So I was born in March and my cousin was born in June. And our mother is our sisters. And so we are exactly the same age and we grew up together. And when I came out to Natasha, my Aunt Kendra, and my mom at the same time. And their reactions were sort of priceless. But it was my mother who said, you know, I love you no matter what. And I can't help but wonder, because I never asked, but I can't help but wonder if the reason she accepted me was because she knew that she was not accepted by her family. But when I told my grandmother, which I won't spoil that because I talk about it in the book, how my grandmother found out that I was gay. My grandmother very much held the Bible to heart, and she explained to me that the lifestyle that I chose was not something that God would support. Similarly, my aunt said the same thing. And as a person of faith today, I know they're wrong. And I also know that, you know, how they interpret the Bible is how they interpret the Bible, and how I live out what I see to be God's calling on my life is just different. And so today we all love one another and we spend holidays together, and at least we try to. So family is always a work in progress. You know, no matter how old you get or how young you are, you know, I have had the joy of building my own family, and that has not come without struggle, but reflects who I am.
Well, and that's another part of the book, which is, you know, you're getting to a relationship with Dee, who's now your wife. And I think that's she's a really important part of this story as well, because that support, that relationship, obviously core to your story.
Yeah. Yeah. 2007 was a big year, I tell you. So my mother passed away in April of 2007, 4 months after Jonathan was born. And I met Danushka online in August of 2007. And we chatted online for like 30 days or something like that, but consistently emailing one another. And most of our communications were done via email, not really chat. And so we got to learn who the other person was well before we met one another. And so we met in person on September 8th in 2007. And as stereotypical lesbians of that time did, we U-hauled and we moved in together that same year. So we knew over email, like, truly who the other person was. And by the time we met, it was just to confirm, you know, hey, you're real, I'm real, here we go. And the funny person that my now wife is, you know, I told her about Jonathan over email, and I told her about my mother over email. And so when we met on that day in September, there were no secrets between us. And so she says, you know, bring him on a date. And I was like, no, who brings a a toddler, 7-month-old, 8-month-old on date. No. And so I did not bring him, but by date 3, I did. And so she met him before he even turned 1. They have a bond that is just, I mean, it was amazing then, but it's truly amazing now because he's a teenager and that comes with a whole nother set of issues. But it's another reminder as we raise this teenager that parenting was not meant to be done alone. And however we figure that out as parents, you know, whether that's building a community of friends that we lean on, it just can't be done alone. It's a hard job, David.
Oh, we know that. It is, it is, you know, anybody with children knows how hard it is.
And yeah,
it's also a lifetime commitment. You're always a parent. It doesn't matter how old your kids are. You're still their parents and you have to figure out how to be with them.
Yes. You
know, they're adults too. And the teenage years, I think in America, teenage years are kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
Not like any place else in history, maybe. Just because of the nature of our society and our culture, teenage years become really fraught.
Right. And they're very privileged, even, you know, just to consider having a cell phone. You know, that is a huge privilege. You know, David, I didn't mention that my wife's family immigrated to the United States, and she is a South Asian woman from Sri Lanka. And when she came out, which I won't share unless you ask me, but it's in the book, the way that she came out to her family. But she hadn't come out until we met to them. And my building a relationship with her family happened over time, but it happened, you know? And so I think it was a huge testament to the strength of love, because, you know, they did not envision their daughter marrying a woman,
right?
Nor a Black woman or a woman with a child, you know? So the list is very long, and, you know, their dream for their daughter was not me. And so, you know, fast forward, you know, my mother-in-law will text me and, you know, give me advice, and unsolicited, by the way, but, you know, we are very close, and there is genuine love there. And, it only happened because they were willing and I was willing. And so, and Danushka, I mean, Danushka is very vocal, and she stands up for what she believes. And so
I have met her and I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, no, I think as you talk about it, obviously for anyone who thinks about how America can be, how things can be, you represent an amazing, transformative, way of being, you know, that we can have multicultural, multi-generational relationship forms, you know, that you can be so many different things and still be a family. And, you know, in today's, you know, we are in, it's February now of 2025. Right. So we can say that we are in a time when that promise and that belief and that representation is under attack. And so, you know, it's impossible to not feel that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you represent something really positive for many of us, and for others, you represent something really not positive, something that they don't believe in.
Right.
And are unwilling, like, unlike your families, both families, yours and Dee's, they are unwilling to be to the change that is required to be accepting,
right,
others.
Yeah.
Anyone who's different.
Right. You know, right.
Or that, and so we, you know, that kind of gets us to another point right now, which is for me and for you and for a lot of people in my family, this is a really difficult time because you are feeling threatened and under attack. And there's a danger in this. You know, a real danger. It's not just a, you know, not just a social danger, but it can be physical sometimes. And so I think that, you know, we have to celebrate who you are and what you've done and the life that you've created, but we also have to find ways to protect you.
Yeah. Thank you for that. You know, I've been thinking, I try not to watch the news, but sometimes I just check on what's happening. And one thing keeps coming back to me, and it's partially my grandmother's fault, but she told me a story about her growing up where she lived in Central Virginia. And as a little girl, in order to go to school, she had to get in the trunk of her white teacher's car to get to school. And I just think about the bravery of that teacher and my grandmother to do that. So to think about where we are today in 2025, as a Black woman, I know that the struggle is not new. The fear is not new. You know, we've been dealing with that as a people for since we arrived, you know, in the United States. And so that's not new, nor is the fear for queer people. That's not new. What is new is how heightened it is, right? So I saw something on the news this morning talking about travel to other countries. And we as queer people, we already take those precautions. We know where we can and can't go. You know, as a Black person, I already take those precautions. In the United States, there are places I won't go, you know? And so while, yes, it's fearful and there is a sense of fear for queer people, people of color, women, none of it's new. And so I think what we have to do is remember that, that it isn't new.
Yeah. Well, know? No, and I think we have to think about it, you know, in ways that are creative and maybe not so much about the fear, but about how to transform that feeling of fear and anxiety into positive action. I think I was actually just reading this just a few minutes ago. I'm going to read this little line.
Yeah.
These are from Audre Lorde, and it's really, this is from Sister Outsider, and it's, I think, really apropos. When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less and less important whether I'm afraid.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, we have to take the power and stand up, because bullies, and we are dealing with bullies.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're really powerful and they can be really dangerous, but they will stand down when you fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Or we have to gain allies in our communities. And this sort of gets me to the other thing I wanted to talk about, because you have two roles in this conversation. One is as a writer,
yeah,
which is about, you know, what these conversations are about, but you also have launched this bookstore called Abodo Serendipity Books in Stratford. For people who don't know, Stratford is a regular American city town of about 55,000 people and has not had a bookstore in a long time. And like many places in America, bookstores, I think, are really valuable and really important. They are places where culture can be defined,
mm-hmm,
where ideas should be, and like libraries,
right,
free to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Books are really important. So, but it's really hard to be a bookseller, as you and I have talked about, and we know. So maybe you should talk a little bit about just what inspired you to open a bookstore, which is it's a really, really hard thing to do.
I'm learning 4 months in, it's almost 5 months in. It's really hard. It has been really hard. And I opened Abodo Serendipity Books in a place, you know, not far from where I live. And I drive by certain storefronts for years. I'm like, you know, it'd be great if there were a bookstore there. Businesses would close. And I would say, you know, it'd be great if there were a bookstore there. And, you know, being a business owner, I've thought about and dreamt about for some time now. And books have, I've always come back to books, right? I've always come back to authors whom I love and books that have changed my perspective on certain ideas. And in 2016, about a year after I gave birth to my daughters, I said, why not me? Like, why not? I can open a bookstore. And so I launched this crowdfunding campaign and I was very like gung-ho about it happening. And the crowdfunding campaign was not as successful as I would like to have been. And so I felt defeated. And so I went back to what I did well. I worked in the nonprofit sector for my entire career. The moment I left college, it was nonprofit for me. And so I went back to that and I kept writing and, you know, got the book deal. And I said, you know, there's an open storefront down the street. And I would love to turn it into a bookstore. Around the same time, a company by the name of Honeycomb Credit reached out to me and they said, you know, I see what you're doing online. So I hosted pop-up shops for about a year and a half in Stratford at different coffee shop tea houses and built sort of a following and started the whole social media thing, which, by the way, is a nightmare. It drives me crazy. But I was very consistent then about posting and sharing where I would be and building partnerships within the community during the same time. And Honeycomb Credit was like, hey, we really love what you're doing. Can we talk about how we can support you? So Honeycomb Credit is an investment tool. And so they support small business owners by way of crowdfunding. And so they take care of all the things that I wouldn't want to do, like emailing their investors and rallying people in Stratford by way of me to donate to the seed costs, the capital needed to open a bookstore. And so I set a goal of $30,000 to raise. We had 30 days to do it and we raised $32,000. And that money went to All Things Bookstore. So I was able to open Oboto Serendipity Books in September. And on February 7th, it will be 5 months that we've been here. And the goal of the bookstore is to be that place in the community members can come into and feel at home. They can look on shelves for everything from romance to nonfiction to children's books and find what they're looking for. And my hope is that when they come in, they're looking for books that will push them out of their comfort zone. One piece of our shop is the social and emotional development of all people. So we provide programming in that vein. We have book clubs for adults, book clubs for middle grade readers. And that is pretty special for our middle grade readers. They lead the book club. And so they choose the book that they're going to read. And we open with different social and emotional learning games that align with the book that they have chosen. And so I work with them and they're typically their moms as we draft questions for the book club. And it has turned into a very inspiring experience, I'd say, for club members. So those kids, some of them would choose the book that host chose, but some of them would not, and they still are reading. I mentioned, you know, a huge part of what I want this to be for this community is a space that everyone feels welcome in. And I will say, according to customer reviews, I've done that and we will continue to do that and work in conversation with community members. You know, if there's a book or a genre that you don't see in the store, tell me and we'll talk about getting it. But something else that warms my heart, David, about our little bookshop here is that we bring authors in. You know, as a writer, as an author myself, I know how important being in front of your readers is, not only for your book, but also for them to have access to you as a person, because as an author, we can sit there, you finish your book and you put it out in the world and hopefully someone will read it. And when you get to sit in front of the people who've read it, you're able to humanize yourself in some way. You know, I think readers sometimes, and myself included, authors are like untouchable. Like you know, they have this amazing book and you love it and you've dog-eared it and you've underlined it, but you're never going to meet them, you know? And so, I'm hoping, you know, in small ways and little by little, we can change that. And the folks here in Stratford are able to see authors that they love. And so we're doing a lot with a little, as we say in the nonprofit world. But I feel really, really confident in our community. Even today, it's February 1st, and we have our mayor coming in to read during story time. And so it is a gem for our community.
Like many other people, I think it's really important to have you in our community. I wish more communities had bookstores today.
Me too.
I think we need to, you know, yes, it is about alternatives to mass merchandising and online bookselling, which is convenient. But as I just read an article this morning, I will share this in other contexts, but Amazon's shopping experience for books is terrible. It was great. You know, yeah. It really was a great opportunity for a lot of people to see books that they couldn't find in their stores and be able to buy them online really easily. That has fostered a lot of reading. But it's become really polluted with advertising and also fake books and AI-generated books and books that are really just taking up space. So the idea that an independent store can provide curation and experience, you know, the personal one-to-one experience, and also being able to be in a room with other readers is really powerful.
Right.
I think we...
Going back to that sentiment, you're not alone, right?
Yes, exactly. And that goes back to what I sort of launched into about the current time we're in. There's nothing more important in times like this than community.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to build your communities wherever you are.
That's
so
right.
So bookstores, I think, are going to be really crucial to that. So I will put your email address and the website in the notes for this episode. So people who want to support you can do that. And hopefully you'll get some more online support this way.
Hopefully.
And so I'm glad that you were able to come on. I think your book is really powerful. I'm just really, I admire it tremendously.
Thank you.
I admire you as a person.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. And I've been talking to Nikia Hargrove, the author of Mama, which I hope you will all go out and read. Thanks so much.
Thank you.